on Express Elevator to Hell. Going down.
Hello out there in podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that help lift those films above the average genre fare. And I just realized that sometimes they're good films and sometimes they're bad.
Yes.
Well, I guess the bad ones have key elements that lift them above too.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say? We need to do a few more bad ones. I've been listening to a couple of bad movie episodes, and they are much funnier than our good movie episodes.
Well, we can react stronger to them, usually, instead of just going,
yes,
this was great, this was great, this was great, that yes. was awesome. Yeah.
Exactly. We would like to thank you if you are returning to listen to us today.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not and you are new, we would like to welcome you to a very, very special episode
Ooh.
Of our podcast. This is Johnny Has the Keys 100th episode.
We need like big graphics and stuff. Drummers.
I mean, I am kind of blown away by it.
Me too.
That's 100 movies.
Yeah.
Or at least, well, 10 of them were Haunting of Hill House first season. But so yeah.
Yeah, but it's
a lot.
It's a lot. And a lot of time, too, because, I mean, I know for me, you and I haven't really talked process a lot, but I know for each of us, we not only watch the movie, we spend time researching it, looking into mm-hmm. it, watching other stuff, sometimes documentaries, sometimes it'll trail us like this one. It got me, so I ended up having to watch the extended version, and I ended up having to watch the third one. Because I wanted
really?
To make sure
I was
that...
going to.
Yeah.
I was going to. And I didn't. I really kind of want to see the third one again now.
Yeah, you need to. Yeah. You need to.
But do I need to see the theatrical version or the print?
Theatrical.
Because I've seen the theatrical version.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Fincher's. It still is. Anyway, we're kind of jumping ahead. Okay. But I don't want to get there too bad.
Yeah. I think we just gave everybody a hint.
Yeah. Well, they should know now. They should have clicked on it because of the title. I mean, come on.
Well, you know what? Let's just tell them about your week then first.
Oh, okay. actually, ironically, my week is kind of, it was a Tim week. What I've been doing, working with the new theater that I am working with, I am working on their schedule for the coming fall. And we are going to do a bunch of movies in October. And so since it's October, hey, that's Tim's world. That's horror land. So we've got three different series that we're going to do. We're going to do Bloody Tuesdays. So it's just gory, gory, gory movies. We're going to do Family Thursdays, which is like the Disney version of Scary.
Monster Squad.
Yeah, Hocus Pocus, you know, those mm-hmm. kind of movies.
Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah. And then Saturday is classic horror. And by classic, I mean it's my definition of what's classic horror. So we're starting with Evil Dead.
That is classic as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So, but it's been really fun kind of putting myself in your shoes and trying to analyze and say, oh, what would work in those three series genres, you know, those categories. You know, we always talk about subcategories or subgenres of each of our genres, but what works for that, for the masses, and hopefully that people will want to come and see on a big screen again, sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, when I think classic, and I'm sure you would too because we're the same age, but I think like Universal or I think Hammer.
Mm.
But I think those are stages, you know, because Universal was the thing at one time. Hammer was the thing at one time. And then the 70s and 80s came along and now it's the Evil Dead and Dawn of the Dead and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a lot of components to the word classic.
Well, and I think to your point, classic changes as time progresses. So you can have your classic Universal, then your classic Hammer, but then you get into your 80s and 90s where a classic is still Halloween. Halloween is a classic October horror movie to me. The Exorcist is a classic horror movie, you know, sort of thing. So, but yeah, it's been fun kind of putting it together from that perspective and looking at, okay, what's gory, but not so gory that, oh my gosh, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to put Fulci on there or something, you know.
Why not? No. I would love to see some of those on a big screen. I mean, I saw Zombie at a drive-in, and that was the biggest, I guess, I ever saw a Fulci film. Actually, no, I saw House by the Cemetery in a theater.
Okay.
Think about it. In Knoxville.
Well, I may reevaluate then and include an Italian zombie. Maybe I should do it. The gore ones should be gore from each kind of either era or location or whatever.
Yeah. And I would go, I would gauge it with Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, like, just use the director in there and then scroll the films and see which one's rated the highest.
Well, ironically, in my notes for today, I have a speech about Rotten Tomatoes, and we'll get to that. But
It's
interesting that you mentioned Rotten Tomatoes. Remind me, and I will definitely tell you something about Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, I have another thing I wanted to ask you. Actually, I may be on to what you're going to say about Rotten Tomatoes. But
no, I doubt it.
Is it the thing on Citizen Kane?
No. Well, no. That is stupid. Just stupid.
Okay. No, what I was going to ask you is, since this is a new venue that you're managing, and they do films as well as other things like theater and music, how do you obtain the films now? How is that, like, just a DVD? What do you do to get the film?
No, you still have to have licensing. So you still have to have rights and licensing. So there are different companies that control those particular libraries. Like, it's taken me, like, Criterion is one. They have an entire collection, of course. Swank is another company, and they control a lot of the Disney-type stuff for smaller independent venues like mine. You have different companies that you go through. One of the hardest ones right now is Turner. Turner Classics is hard to get a hold of rights to. But you have to let them know the dates and let them know, you know, your venue size, all the particulars. And then they'll give you a quote for how much that, you know, rental is going to be. And sometimes they'll send it to you digitally. You know, you'll get a downloaded encrypted file that then you project with your projector. Or you can, or they'll send you their encrypted DVD. You know, and you have to return it. It's kind of like Redbox for, you know, our Netflix used to be.
That's so strange.
Yeah, because you're just renting it, sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. I was just curious how that worked, especially with, you know, old obscure films like Zombie or, you know, Beyond the Door.
Well, and some of those I might not be able to get a hold of. So I've got to take that into consideration, too. You know, what titles can you actually get licensing for? You know, we'll see, you know, what I get and what I can do. And I'll probably update it later on, you know, whatever. So,
okay.
Yeah. For our 100th, I'm living in Tim's world. So
nice. Well, I'm still in my world as well.
What do you do?
Well, the other day, I've had a lot going on, in my other job as far as publishing, and I decided I needed to see a horror movie. I hadn't watched one in a while, and I wanted to find a really good one, so I did the Google thing and said, what's, you know, the best horror streaming now or whatever. And I came across this movie that got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I, well, this is it. It's called His House.
I love the picture, but I've never heard of it.
It's a British film, BBC. It stars two unknowns. I mean, they're not really unknowns. I've got their names here. It was directed by a first-time director. He's done a few shorts, but nothing major, named Remy Weeks. And it starred Sope Dirisu, I may be butchering that name, and Wunmi Mosaku. I'm not sure of their backgrounds, but they play Sudanese refugees that okay. escape to England. And Matt Smith is in it.
Okay.
And he was, wasn't he a Doctor Who
Doctor
or something?
Who. Yep.
Okay. He is like their, I want to say probation officer, but he's the one that like puts them in their housing and the one that they have, he has to meet with weekly in order to retain their right to stay in England. Like they can't work, they can't, you know, they get 74 pounds a week. They live in this horrible dump of a, I don't know, I would call it a tenement house or something. But anyway, that's what that's about. It, the tenement house is haunted. And I mean, it is, I don't know how to explain this, but this movie is fantastic. This is a movie I would put on our list. It is, it works on several different levels of horror.
Mm-hmm.
And it is unique and very much like that movie we discussed a few weeks ago, The Dark and the Wicked. It is that creepy atmospherically, yet when you find out why it's happening...
Yes.
When you find out why it's happening, it's like a gut punch. I mean, you're like, holy shit, this movie is... It blew me away. I mean, it is with me still. It has been 2 days since I watched it, and I can't stop thinking about it.
How did you find it again? You just looked it up right. randomly?
Well, I sometimes Google what's the best horror streaming, and then most of them will have recent dates, like May 2021 or June 2021 or whatever is the closest to where we're at now. And then I look at that, and I find out where it is. This movie is on Netflix. It's been on there for a while, and I just never watched it because I didn't know anything about it. So when I looked it up on Rotten Tomatoes and saw 100%, I was like, okay, this is the movie I'm watching.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. A good find. Yeah.
Very good find. I highly recommend it. That thing, that creature in the picture behind me is really creepy, but that's not all that's creepy about this movie.
Yeah, for those of you watching us on YouTube, you're getting the better shot than those of you listening on the podcast.
Well, and you feel so sorry for these people because all they want to do is get out of a country where they're going to die because it's just two tribes killing each other. And they get to England and they're in a house that they can't really stay in.
Right.
And they're required to stay in it because of the government.
Yep.
In order to keep their freedom there or their whatever it's called when you... defect from a country to Britain.
Right.
I'm not sure what the legalese is.
Well, when you immigrate or and seek asylum, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, highly, highly recommended.
Wow. Scary.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, that brings us to, I guess, another creature that we've been alluding to.
Yeah, briefly or a little bit, we've talked about it. Tim is extremely good at putting together our lists. We'll each throw out ideas long before we plan the season, and Tim is the one that actually throws all the season together. So I think I should thank you for this being our 100th. This is a landmark film, I would have to say, going into it in several different ways. We are going to talk today about 1986's Aliens, with an S, the sequel to Ridley Scott's extremely popular gothic haunted house in space movie, Alien, which we covered. Did we cover that last year or first year?
We covered it on the first season. It was our 14th episode, and 14th. It bisected Haunting of Hill House. We did like 5 episodes of that, then we did Alien, then we did the other 5 episodes of Hill House.
So, yeah, so if you guys have either listened to us before or are new to us, either one, go back to Season 1, Episode 14, and listen to Alien and see what we compare it to this. This one was written and directed by James Cameron, produced by his just-married wife, Gail Ann Hurd. The producers were the same as Alien, so it was Carroll, Giler, and Hill all produced it. It was interesting that Dan O'Bannon's name was missing from a lot of this, other than original story. But mm-hmm. he had nothing really to do with the screenplay, had nothing to do with his production whatsoever. It was filmed, again, at Pinewood in England. Basically, a brief, simple synopsis is it's 57 years later, warrant officer Ripley, the only surviving member of the Nostromo crew of the original movie, her space pod is found floating in space just by sheer luck, as Paul Reiser's character says. She is awakened from hypersleep. Bark. She tells everyone that about the alien and about what happened. She ends up being kind of loosely coerced to go back to the planet that she had fled from and barely survived from with a...
Well, almost bribed.
Yes. Yeah, essentially, coerced, bribed. With a group of, very well-trained colonial Marines who will protect her to destroy the alien and make sure. When she gets there, things are not as they anticipated or as they wanted, and they go downhill extremely rapidly, and we are on a roller coaster ride of fear and craziness for the next action. Hour. It is all action. What did? When was the first time you saw this movie? Did you see it at theatrical?
I saw this movie 5 times in a theater. I cannot remember the first time. It was probably with you. It wouldn't surprise mm-hmm. me if it yeah. wasn't. But I do remember a time I saw it with you, because it was with you and Amy Horn, and uh-huh. we had both seen it, and she had not, and. During the middle of one of the action sequences, the power went out and the theater went black.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
I do remember that. Yeah.
And someone, it may have been you, I can't remember if it was us or not, shouted, "There's an alien in the projector booth."
Mm-hmm.
But it came on shortly after.
I would ever
after.
Have done that. No.
But I do remember that time. So I saw this movie several times in the theater.
Me too.
For sure.
Me too. And I'm pretty sure we saw it at least twice together.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it several other times. I've seen it several times since on mm-hmm. VHS, on DVD, on Blu-ray, and then watched
television.
It again this time. And like I said, then watched the extended cut, which I had never seen.
Me either.
So that was interesting. And actually, I will preface everything we're going to say right now. If you have a chance to watch the extended cut, watch it. I think it is a better movie to the theatrical cut. One of those rare exceptions where the director dicks with it after he's released it and it's actually better.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to Close Encounters or something like that, or Star Wars where they dick with it and it's not good.
Nah.
Again, watching it this week, going into it, I really wanted to hate it. Again, every time I watch it, I want to hate it because James Cameron's name's attached to it, because I don't like James Cameron. But 3 of my favorite movies he has directed and or written and directed. Terminator is a great movie and is well mm-hmm. done. This movie is a great movie and is well done. And The Abyss is another one.
Okay.
But I hate Avatar. I hate Titanic. I don't like the man himself, and I will just state right up front, I also watched 2 makings of this, and they could not stop talking about how terrible it is to work with James Cameron. The only 2 people that had good things, well, Michael Biehn, of course, loves him, and says several times, whatever Jim wants, we give it to him, and yeah, he can get a little heated sometimes, da-da-da. Sigourney says, Jim Cameron's brilliant, he's great to work with. And Lance Henriksen says, I like working with Jim on anything he wants. But everybody else, including the girl who played Newt, said that he was very scary. He's very intimidating. All of the special effects, you've got to watch this one documentary, because all the special effects guys, they even preface it by saying, Jim, of course, came from design and came from, so he knows so much about special effects anyway and how they're done. So you can't ever do anything.
He was on Planet or Galaxy of Terror.
Yeah, with Roger Corman.
Right.
But they go, you can't ever do anything, to confuse. Jim will always say, no, you can't do that. You do it this way.
What the hell are we supposed to use, man? Harsh language?
To play devil's advocate, though, there's a history with this film and the crew in England not liking him.
Oh, of course.
Because Terminator had not come out yet. So they all thought he didn't know what he was doing. And they didn't trust him.
Well, Terminator had come out by the time they filmed it, but just barely, and not really in England.
Which it is had not come out it. In England. No one knew who he was.
Well, and they also, he's filling the shoes of Ridley Scott, one of their best directors. And
right.
So, yeah.
And there was one person on the crew. I've got his name. It's like in my trivia. It's not important. Anyway, there was one guy that was on the crew that did like him and has returned to work with him again all the way through, like, Titanic. But the rest of the crew just were very, I don't know. They didn't respect him, and they didn't like Gail because she was a woman, and they thought she got her job because he was married to her or that mm-hmm. they were a couple or whatever. They didn't like him. Now, I agree with you on what we've read as far as his history and being somewhat of a tyrant of a director. But I don't know that he was at the time. I think he was still sort of a novice.
Oh, no, he was. If you watch documentaries of the making of this, it's so good. Because he goes, like they're doing the facehugger scene, and he's wanting it to, you know, be pulled by a wire and hit the lens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he's looking through the camera, of course. The way he does a lot, the cinematographer just has to step back and let Jim work the camera. But Ridley was the same way, so there you go. But anyway, and he's going, okay, now pull it. No, no, what the hell are you doing? Why are you doing it that way? No, put it here, raise your left arm, raise your left, you know, and he's just yelling at this guy.
Wow.
And they talk about, they tell horror stories of him on the set.
Okay.
Of stuff he did.
Well, that being said, we have done more movies by him on this podcast than any other director.
Well, he...
and Ridley Scott is number two.
Well, good. Well, Ridley deserves it. We need to do Stanley Kubrick next. No. But
actually, after this season, Stanley will be up there, I think.
But, you know, Cameron, begrudgingly, I have to admit, you know, Cameron will go down in history for the cinema, even more so to me than Spielberg. And Spielberg, I think, is a much better storyteller. But he has the blockbusters. You know, his Titanic, no, Avatar went above Endgame again. And he sent, stuff to the guys saying,
I don't really remember it. I need to watch it again. Especially since there's sequels coming out and Disney has an entire world in Animal Kingdom.
Oh, of Avatar?
Yeah.
No, don't watch it again. Don't. It is one of the worst scripts I've... Never mind. Anyway, but I have in my notes here, just to start us off with, this is a great sequel. As a matter of fact, this is a great example of how to do a sequel. Mm-hmm. To extend the story without repeating the story.
And you can have different elements to it.
And mm-hmm. homages to it. And even the style of the first one, you can have an homage scene to without it being pandering, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. IMDb ranks this as the best sequel ever made. It's even higher than Empire Strikes Back, which is saying a lot.
I wouldn't disagree with them.
Screen Rant ranks this as the third best sequel ever made. Rotten Tomatoes, guess what they rank it as?
The 10th? I don't know.
The 12th. They rank it as the 12th best sequel. Because you know what number one is to Rotten Tomatoes? You know what the number one Rotten Tomatoes sequel is?
Oh, it's going to be something good like Home Alone.
Paddington 2.
Hey, you know what? I've never seen it. Maybe it's pretty good.
No, it's not. It's not pretty good. That's why I just, we've mentioned it before on the podcast. I do not trust Rotten Tomatoes.
I do not
trust them at all.
I don't look at lists like that. I look just the ratings.
Well, like you were talking about Citizen Kane. For the first time in ever, Citizen Kane was knocked off the throne of the best, quote, best movie ever made. Because they found a review that trashed it from you know, when it first came out. And right. that ended up bringing its analytics down below Paddington. Paddington, the bear. Is the best movie ever made? No, it is not. And, you know, if you Google Inside Rotten Tomatoes, if you go to their search bar and say best science fiction movie, guess what number one is?
Oh, it's going to be good. Galaxy of Terror.
Wizard of Oz, they think is the best science fiction
movie. You know what? I have problems with Amazon and that, too, because a lot of horror is considered science fiction on Amazon.
I know. Yeah. Well, and number two on Rotten Tomatoes is Black Panther. Black Panther is not science fiction.
No, but movie. We would classify it as that if we were doing it on the podcast.
Well, because we kind of bordered into that adventure superhero
Vibranium,
world.
Man. Vibranium.
You know. Avengers Endgame is number three, and the number four science fiction movie on Rotten Tomatoes is Toy Story 4. So, sorry, I don't trust him. And I even did your world. Do you know what number one, the best horror movie on Rotten Tomatoes is?
Us. Oh, it's going to be like something stupid like that's recent, like that doll movie or something.
Close. Us.
Annabelle.
It's, huh? It's Us, the second.
Oh, really? I haven't even Jordan seen that.
Jordan Peele movie. Right. And number two is Get Out. Which is a good horror movie, but it is not the best horror movie by any means.
No.
So I do not trust Rotten Tomatoes. That's my end of my speech and my rant on Rotten Tomatoes and the fact that I don't see why people trust them because their analytics are obviously very screwed.
Well, and I don't just go by them. I just use them in a consensus. So, I mean, because I use IMDb and some other things as well.
Well, there you go. Do you want to talk about scenes, our favorite scenes, or favorite things you like? Because that's going to be hard in this movie, I think.
It is. I didn't know if we had, are we past the background? We talked about the controversy of the set, and we'll get to cast. So, yeah, scenes, I would say, would probably be next.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of background about this movie. I mean, if we wanted to finish up just some of that or trivia or whatever. Yeah,
well, you mentioned that Dan O'Bannon's not mentioned, and I thought that was interesting because we just did Return of the Living Dead and he directed it. Mm-hmm. Which is, how do I do this? I did not do that intentionally, but that is kind of a poetic
Well, the choice. Embryo of this was they, you know, 20th Century Fox basically came back to Giler and said, is there anything you guys could do with Alien? Could we do a sequel to it? And Giler's original pitch back on it was, we're imagining a cross between Magnificent Seven and Southern Comfort. And it's because he and Hill had done Southern Comfort, the movie, and they were working on a remake of Magnificent Seven. So he said, is there a way we could do something with aliens that's like that, or with an alien sequel? They were calling it Alien 2 at the time. Cameron was commissioned to write it.
Well, didn't he write it while he was filming Terminator? Didn't we say he was writing a bunch of movies at the same time?
Correct.
Rambo and or something.
And his take on it was, I'm not going to, he said the original was a gothic horror movie. And I'm not going to do a gothic horror movie. I'm going to do a combat movie. And Giler and Hill and everyone loved that idea. 20th Century Fox loved that idea. He wrote the screenplay. They liked it so much that they said, we'll wait until Terminator, until you finish Terminator. And until it comes out. And if it's good, you can direct this, even though we've never worked with you as a director before.
Yeah.
So that says a lot about that screenplay. And based on interviews that Sigourney Weaver gave, that's what bought, because she had been shown a couple of other variations of Alien sequels and didn't like them. But she really liked the screenplay and how strongly it emphasized Ripley and the familial bond and the mother-daughter stuff. And she said her character was so well-rounded in the screenplay she read that it hooked her, even though she had never worked with Cameron or really knew who he was.
Right.
So,
and I mean, and it's not just her. I mean, there's echoes of Mother in this because of the Queen Alien, too. So you've got the bond between her and Newt, but then you've also got the mother of the other species. It's like Mother's battling.
Yeah, the big themes I've got laid out in this are families in general. Mm-hmm. So the family of the colonists, the family of the corporation, which basically comes through all the whole series. But families with the alien, families with the crew, mm-hmm. the, you know, Ripley and the girl, the mother-daughter, and then the mother and her daughters, meaning the queen. Yeah, that whole mm-hmm. that's a huge thematic all the way through this.
It is. It mm-hmm. is. And then you've got the whole military aspect, which just amps everything up.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the cast. I mean, the cast is just perfect. And I do have a few notes on some things that could have happened. But I just love everybody in this movie. Even that little Bert guy, the guy that did the sitcom. I can't think of his name.
Paul Reiser.
Paul Reiser. Yep. I mean, he is such a jerk. And I had never seen him before. And then he went on to become like America's favorite comedian on Mad About You.
Mad About You. Which is just wild. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got other makings of, yes, the cast for this is great. The way they worked with the cast. Again, they brought the bulk of the Marines they brought in and actually worked with them in Marine training prior to filming. So Cameron had people putting them through Marine training, so they would look like they, you know, and Cameron wanted it to have a Vietnam feel. So he wanted them to be a little insolent, to be a little hyper macho sort of thing, which at times still bothers me. Every time I watch this, I kind of go, like the whole, have you ever been, just, you know, mistaken for a man? No, have you? You know, it's just like, a little bit too much dialogue for me.
I think it's a great line, and there's a history to it, actually. I'll get into that in the keys.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. but then getting the cast they got, Michael Biehn came on last minute. I did not mm-hmm. know this. This is something I found out. Did you know
I didn't know it either. I've got it all in my casting notes, yeah.
So that was a casting one. Well, what do you have casting notes-wise? You go there for a while.
Well, of course, we have Sigourney Weaver, who had to come back. I mean, and there was a little bit of a worry that she was not going to come back. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he played some kind of trick that made someone else's agent call her agent or something, saying they were going to go ahead with the movie without her. And let the word of mouth get back to her, and that's when she signed on.
It was Schwarzenegger's agent that he had worked with on Terminator.
Yes, it was. It was Schwarzenegger's agent, and I guess his agent knew her agent. And they were worried that she was not going to do it, so they kind of put a fire under her indirectly, is what they did. It was like a little Hollywood magic. Carrie Henn, who played Newt, the little girl, Rebecca, she actually never has done another movie and has been haunted by the word mostly for her entire life.
We better get back because it'll be dark soon and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
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 It's one of my favorite lines in the movie.
Oh, my God. Awesome. I listen to a podcast right now where the guy does it all the time. And David Farmer used to do it all the time. I mean, that line lives in people's heads.
They mostly come out at night. Yeah. Mostly.
Mostly. And she is not British, but she was raised in England. So occasionally she does sound British on mm-hmm. some of her line deliveries. Michael Biehn, as you said, plays Hicks. Originally, James Remar was cast, and he is another good actor that was in Warriors. That's the first thing that comes to mind.
Yep.
And Walter Hill movies like 48 Hours. Isn't that Walter Hill? I think that
is. Yep.
But apparently, last minute, he got fired because mm-hmm. of drugs. He got busted. He was apparently a bad drug addict at the time. And I think that was very beneficial because I think Michael Biehn is great in this part. And it was probably a huge blessing for him to be able to step into that role so fast. And by fast, I mean they had already filmed scenes with Remar. So there are actually scenes where you don't see Bean's face, and it's actually Remar standing there from behind or whatever.
Yep.
So if you don't know who James Remar is, I would suggest looking him up. You will recognize him.
Yes, especially from the 80s. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Stephen Lang also auditioned for the role of Hicks and for the role of Burke, who was, like we said, played by Paul Reiser. He didn't get the part, but he did go on to be Quaritch in Avatar, which is another Cameron movie we mentioned. So he has kind of joined the Cameron family, even though he didn't make it into this particular film. Mm-hmm. And they were going to let Bean play his part in Avatar, but since Sigourney Weaver was already in it, they were afraid it would look like an Aliens reunion and decided, no, we better not do that. So that's how
probably smart he went on. Mm-hmm. For them, for that.
Yeah. And then I really don't have any other alternate castings, but we mentioned Paul Reiser's in it. Lance Henriksen plays Bishop, the android. Of course, they had to have an android element similar to...
He prefers artificial person.
Yes, he does. Artificial person. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, echoing the android that Ian Holm played, Ash, from the first film. My personal favorite, of course, is Bill Paxton, who plays Hudson. He is the comic relief, I guess you would say, of the movie, because he is the wisecracking Marine that always has something smartassy to say.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
He uses the word man 35 times in this film and the word fuck 25 times. No, excuse me. The word fuck was said 25 times, and 18 of them are his.
Yes. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. So that's why he's my favorite character.
I think Paxton, you know, he will always be remembered for this role. Mm-hmm. This was his defining role. I mean, much more so than, you know, I saw some negative reviews, and they were saying, so what did James Cameron do? Did he see Weird Science and go, hey, that guy, get that guy and let him just do that same thing again?
His name was Chet. And I was going to say, Chet. I remember him from Weird Science.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he asked Wyatt how he would like to have a greasy pork sandwich served in a dirty ashtray.
Yeah. One of the best lines in the movie. And he has, you know, the bulk of the quotable lines in this movie. You know, we're in some sweet shit now, man.
Right.
You know, just
and if you watch the extended version, he's got more that I never had heard before.
When he's talking about the Queen Anne going, man, and they're big. Those queens are big. And he's holding up his hand like that. He is a great comic foil in this. He works well. He plays it just to that borderline without it getting so stupid that you really hate the character. As a matter of fact, you end up hating Paul Reiser's character a lot more, which is good storytelling, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Gorman, I think, is a bit of a cliche in this. He plays a little, you know, it's that typical, the fresh green lieutenant in the Vietnam story.
I'm in charge,
story.
But I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. His name is William Hope, and I looked him up because he's got a very familiar face. And he's been in a lot, but you know what he's done a ton of that kind of blew my mind? He has, like, I mean, dozens of Thomas the Train animation where he does voice work. So he must be, like, a major character on Thomas the Train. I guess it's PBS. It's some kind of kids show.
Maybe he's Thomas, you know.
It's not.
He could be the train, maybe.
Or the conductor, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, He's big in voice acting.
Thomas is a sentient train, you know.
Okay.
Thomas talks.
I'll believe you.
I'm serious.
After that, we've got Vasquez. Did you want to continue with Lieutenant Gorman? I'm sorry.
No, I just saw Gorman is probably of all the characters in it, even some of the lesser Marines that I don't even remember their names, but like, oh, I have to hold all the explosives, guys, now I'm going to blow up. And, oh, I'm the doctor girl. Now I'm going to get killed. Even them, to me, have a little bit more character development than Gorman, except Gorman does have a great death with Vasquez. You know, that's a good scene.
It is a good scene.
So.
And she's the one that probably respects him the least, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of Vasquez, she is played by Jeanette Goldstein. Mistaken for a man. I didn't mean to call her a he.
That doesn't sound like a very Hispanic name to me.
It's not. I would venture to say she's Jewish, but she does play other nationalities. I read where she's Scottish on or Irish on some pretty popular show. I can't remember what it was. She is well respected in Hollywood as a character actress. And she must like Cameron because she's been on several of his projects or what I would call peripheral
Well, let me ask you, in projects. Our super sensitive society now, do you think she could have been cast in that part if they were filming it now? Or do you think there would be huge outcry?
From the trans community?
No, from the Hispanic community.
Oh.
You know, because... Like, what's her name? Tilda Swinton, Swinton, mm-hmm. whatever. Who was in Doctor Strange, who played the ancient one.
Yeah,
Tilda Swinton. Got huge flack because she's supposed to be Oriental, and she's not. Scarlett Johansson, huge flack for Ghost in the Shell because she's supposed to be anime. She's supposed to be Oriental, or Japanese or ethnic or whatever the correct term is now. Because I heard that there was a little bit of outcry at the time that they cast Jeanette Goldstein in a obviously Hispanic role and she wasn't. And to me it says, hey, that's a good actor or actress. It doesn't mean that we're trying to be racially what do they say when you take somebody else's race stuff away from them? Oh crap. You know what I mean? You don't want to wear cowboys and Indians headdresses because you're.
I don't know enough about it to really venture an opinion. I mean, I'm like you. I think that if you're good in the part, you should get the part. I don't have a problem with straight people playing gay people, and I don't have a problem with gay people playing straight people.
Right. And I don't have an issue. To me, it says you're a good actor if you can play a different ethnicity. I don't have an issue with it. But a lot of super sensitives do. It's that whole thing that came up with cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. The whole, okay, you can't dress your kid as an Indian for Halloween because you're insulting the Native Americans. And I'm like, what? Really? What?
I know that has gone away. I mean, I wouldn't be dressing up that way for Halloween anymore. Even Western movies have gotten away from that, I think.
Well, okay, another good example. Johnny Depp played Tonto.
Right, right.
And got in huge trouble for it, you know, kind of thing. Or flack or feedback or whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, she does a great job. Who cares? She's a great
vegetarian. I think she does a great job, too. I would venture to say she's so butch that she could possibly be trans or be a lesbian. However, she clearly has a very strong friendship or a relationship with the guy that plays Drake, the blonde.
Yeah,
guy.
Mark Ralston. Mark Ralston is the actor. Yeah, I think their bond is really good and cool, mm-hmm. and I like the strength that it gives both of those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then the only one I've got casting wise is Apon, who actually was a Marine.
Right,
I found out, and so that's why he is very Full Metal Jacket all the way through this. So
assholes and elbows or something. Yeah,
that's a key.
Another day in the Corps. Yeah, he's great. I had a couple of you're right. Apone, and then Mark Ralston played Drake, and then very briefly Rico Ross played Frost, who is one of the first ones killed. I think, is he the one set on fire? I think he gets caught on fire.
Frost, yeah, he's the one that's holding all the ammunition and gets hit with the flamethrower and drops it and falls down, and then it blows up. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So yes. Just a very overall. Incredibly strong ensemble,
mm-hmm.
Led by Sigourney. And I love some of the things she does to get respect. Like you were talking about scenes. We never really did a lot of the scenes.
Yeah.
One of the scenes that I love is when Gorman can't make the decision to pull them out, and she's like, get them out of there, you know, and he's like yelling at her and yelling at himself and freaking out, and she just says, fuck it, man, and she goes up and she starts driving the vehicle to go mm-hmm. in and rescue them, and I'm like, huge respect. I mean, I have huge respect for her. Those people's lives she's saving are going to respect her because she just doesn't give a shit. She's not military.
Well, I think it's very interesting, and maybe we could even do a side Patreon thing or something on it, but this, you know, we've hinted at times or talked at times in the podcast about the Me Too movement and the mm-hmm. elevation of females, not only in great acting roles, but also, you know, being recognized by the Academy in directing and in writing and all this kind of stuff. And so we're in a new kind of, I think, renaissance for females. But it was like George Romero casting a black man as his lead, Ridley right. Scott casting a female as his dramatic lead in mm-hmm. a horror movie, you know, kind of thing where she's not the victim. She right. is actually a strong female. And I think Cameron does that in this. He gives Ripley her such a strong identity, and coupled with the emotion that she plays. You know, without the scenes with Newt, I don't think it would have worked as well. And so that's great storytelling to me and character development mm-hmm. that she can have that scene where she's like going, fuck it, and just taking over the scene with the big fight with the queen at the end. But then she has these sensitive moments with Newt talking about the hot chocolate and, oh, there's a little girl under there. I guess I better wipe the rest of it away, you know, kind of thing. And then the scene, just the scene with no dialogue, really, of her and her mom, you know, her seeing her mom in the extended version. Just some great, great performances and character work.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. Did you want to continue with a few other scenes?
Sure. Yeah, sure. It's our 100th. We can do whatever we want.
Happy birthday. I like the one that's behind me, where we finally get a glimpse of an actual living colonist that's been, what would you call that? Imprisoned? Not imprisoned.
Cocooned.
Cocooned, yeah.
Stored.
And to breed an alien. And when they find her, she opens her eyes and it scares them because they think she's dead already. And the first thing she says is, kill me. And then a chest burster comes bursting out of her chest. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, we really never saw that other than the...
Cain.
Yeah, other than Cain and the dream that Ripley has at the beginning of this where it almost happens. So I was like, that's kind of an iconic scene in itself because now we take it for granted.
Yeah, there have been so many sequels and so many mm-hmm. chestbursters that, yeah. I do think that's a kind of a pivot scene, but it also is a complaint scene for me. I do like the fact that that, to me, is a great example of an homage to the original without replicating the original totally. We get a chestbuster, but it's not the same way. They're not eating, not sitting around a table. They're not, you know, it's not a surprise. Total surprise.
Well, I mean, it is a surprise, but I see what you mean, yeah.
But to me, it does bring up the fact, and especially in the theatrical version, I have this issue, but I didn't as much when I watched the extended because of the scenes he inserted or left in. But the whole timeline's kind of weird and wonky. You know, how long were these colonists, how long has Newt been surviving? Because this lady's been just hanging here? Alive for weeks, just waiting for the Marines to come to pick her head up so that the chest buster could burst out? I mean, how long? It just didn't make sense to me. It kind of seemed convenient that the chest buster chose this moment to come out.
That's true. That's true. I don't know. Maybe she had a medical condition. Maybe she was in a coma.
Yeah. Well, the timeline is really screwy. And I even took when I in my notes over here, when I watched the original again, one of my first notes was, wait, so the company has known about this alien for 57 years and they didn't do anything? Because the company sent them there. The company right. and alien sends them and sends Ash along to get this particular specimen and bring it back. So they know it's there. Right? But yet it's been 57 years and they haven't sent another mission or gone back or done anything. And
you know, you leading me to a question I had. Did the company go to the planet specifically to get the alien, or did they only want the alien once Ash let them know it was there?
Well, I got the impression when up until watching, you know, up until the night before last when I watched the extended version, up until then, I had always thought this was just a major screw up in the company. The company just obviously either forgot about, maybe they sent out a bunch of ashes and a bunch of missions to try to find alien life, and this is just one that never reported back. So they went, didn't work, right? Or some screw up, and they just, it didn't make any sense to me that they would not have sent something else, and or if there's a colony on this planet, why they wouldn't send to investigate. But according to the extended version, until Ripley tells her story and where the ship is located, they didn't even know it was there. And it wasn't until she told Burke the story that he told them to go look for it.
Okay.
And that's why, ironically, again, a little bit too much of a bad storytelling, but Newt's parents are the ones that actually find the alien.
Yeah, that part I could have done without. I also wonder if the oxygenator or whatever had something to do with it. Like, maybe that's why they waited to go back until that technology was available. I don't know.
Yeah, or I can kind of, you know, what do they call it? Retconning. And people have used another term they start to call it, like, mind conning. In my own mind, my own justification is that was a totally different company that the colonists are a different company. They don't have nothing to do with Watani. That's a totally different company that goes out and terraforms planets. It just so happens they picked this planet to terraform, and Watani knows that there's a possible alien there. Mm-hmm. They sent a ship there 57 years ago. It never came back. So it isn't until Ripley confirms that Burke goes, oh, we need to send somebody over there, and we need to get a mission out there really quick.
Right.
You know, and I was thinking again, okay, so they're all, again, nitpicking as I do.
But, oh, no, if you're going to nitpick, we can nitpick the ending. The ending's what pisses me off.
Oh, me too. I'm yeah. all over that. But they have to go into hyperspace. How far away is this planet? And how long did Newt live then? Because they don't leave for the mission until they say, we've lost touch with the colony, so we need your help, Ripley.
And she right. says, okay. And if they have to go into hypersleep, it would be years.
So Newt, I mean, well, at least a big bulk of months, let's say. So let's say it's, for sake of argument, 9 months. So Newt has been living in that hole under the floor and surviving for 9 months. And so has this chick behind you.
Right. Against That's the wall. What I was thinking. But I think, doesn't Ripley say how long she's been surviving? Doesn't she say 9 weeks or something? Or so many weeks? Like, when Bill Paxton's complaining, Hudson, he says something about, we're not going to survive.
Well, we put her in charge.
Exactly. But it's when he says 12 days, and he goes, we're not even going to last 12 hours. And Ripley points at Newt and says, she lasted so many days.
I'll have to double check that. I don't think she says a time. I think she says she lasted that long without any weapons. She's lasted this long without any weapons, da 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 da.
I know. I could have sworn she gave a time.
I don't think she gives a time. But if she does, I'll need to look back there.
And that's interesting.
The timeline of this movie is really wonky.
Yeah, it is. And if they have to go into hypersleep, that makes it even wonkier. I'd never really even thought about it. Because that would take even longer. It would make more sense if they had, you know, some new form of travel, like warp speed or something.
Yeah, it's been 57 years, and they have a huge station orbiting Earth now that they didn't have before.
Interesting. Yeah, I never really thought about it.
Yeah, well, again, it's one of those where you don't worry about it at the time, because Cameron constructs the story in such a way that you're ready for the ride, and you're having a good time. But also, it's his, you know, the only reason they have to is because he has to have his homage to the birth sequence, to the waking up sequence that Ridley did at the beginning of the movie, Alien. So he has to do his version, which is, it's not just five pods, it's nine, and they're all in a line, and they look so cool, and these are all Marines, you know, and this is my wake-up section. So, but it's still scenes. We were talking scenes, and we got distracted because I went off.
That's okay. You've gone off several times today.
I have. I have. Again, I like three of the sequences that are in the extended version that are not in the real version, are in the theatrical version. Mm-hmm. I do like the colonist scene, two scenes. I like the scene with them first getting the communication saying we need to send somebody out there, and you see the families and you see people working and all that, and see.
Yeah, I liked all that. I just thought it was kind of convenient that it was Newt's dad's the one that gets the facehugger.
Yeah, but I do like the sequence going out and finding it and looking at it on the small screen and all that. But then suddenly Daddy comes back with a facehugger and we got to go.
Right.
You know, I didn't like that.
And the long scream.
Ah! Yeah, her.
That scream was long. Kind of, yeah. I was like, shut up.
And the other extended scene that I really like is when they're theorizing about the Queen. And I think the movie really needed that rather than just Ripley's line of, so where do the eggs come from? And then they cut it. In the extended scene, they go off on, well, maybe it's like ants or something. That's when Hicks goes, are you kidding me? Ants are this fucking big, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked all of that. As a matter of fact, I think Fox just made him cut it for length and pacing.
Yeah, it was just a pacing.
Because the movie was already cut to 2 hours and 15 minutes. This new version is like 2 hours and 35 minutes, or the extended version. And Sigourney took offense to it, because one of the reasons she came on board was because of the mother daughter relationship, and a lot of that was sacrificed in this cut for pacing or whatever.
Yeah, and you know, we lose the robotic machine sentries. I thought that was a cool scene and was neat and added to the suspense a little bit. And the only other thing extended-wise I'll say in my notes that I saw was it makes more sense, because the way it's edited, Ripley actually puts puts her in the room to go to sleep before Bishop tells them that there's an emergency and we only have 4 hours left. And in the theatrical version, it never made sense to me. It goes, I was thinking, could you really put the little girl to sleep and then later on crawl in there beside her and go to sleep if you only have 4 hours? I think your adrenaline would not let that happen.
No.
You know?
It's funny that you say that, because I remember having seen this movie so many times, the original cut, Bert just saying, coming to her door and saying something's happened with the colony. And I thought, well, that was fast. But he broke it up with that scene with the colony, and I was like, oh, I never knew that was there. That's why he had that in there, so it wasn't so sudden when Burke comes to tell her there's a problem.
Right, right. And I think that works a lot better, plus the fact that he already has a relationship with her, because he's the one that actually brings her information about her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's established. And you get to see a little bit more extended scene with the Inquisition or whatever.
The Tribunal or whatever. Yeah.
Where they tell her she's stripped of all duties and all that.
And they take her license away. And that's kind of what he uses to bribe her to go back, is that you'll be reinstated.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of his scenes with the motion trackers work in this movie very well. I love when the way he does the concept of saying, okay, I'm only going to observe these Marines. And this is one that, again, we reach out to our listeners and I say, give me a key that this inspired, because I think it has, but I can't think of one. But the fact that that Gorman is actually watching all the Marines on their own individual cameras, and then he's watching them slowly die. That whole sequence is great.
It is great.
Just the way it builds suspense.
The chaos.
The way it works. Yes. Mm-hmm. The fact that they are so buttoned up and so good. Then he tells them to remove their clips. And then they don't know what to do. And then chaos to see.
What are we supposed to use, man? Harsh language?
That's Frost. That's the guy that
it is. Is it Frost? Yeah, it is Frost. Yeah, that's a great line. And I love how Vasquez already has extra clips and gives one to Drake.
Well, and you know, in the original, when they, you know, they see the derelict at a distance and they climb up through the vagina hole and everything else, and then it suddenly cuts and we see the interior and see all the organic walls and all that kind of Giger stuff. I like the way Cameron did it with going from that real industrial ladders and, you know, a big industrial feel, and suddenly they're all look, and we're only seeing their cameras look around, and suddenly everything starts getting organic. And you know, that's a great homage to the original, because all of us who've seen Alien are going, oh, no, don't go in there. That is not the place to go.
That's the haunted house.
Nope. That's the haunted house. Yes. Right. Yeah. Don't go in there, man.
Yeah. We've been talking scenes, and that scene with the chaos. I mean, the only thing I can connect it with is, I mean, I could easily see a zombie scene shot that way, where they send a bunch of guys in to take care of a building, and all of a sudden things just go wrong, terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah,
and they're get so each person's camera. Yeah.
Oh, you've been hearing Macho for the past 20 minutes. You're so sure that they're going to be so good, and then they lose it like almost immediately.
Right. Well, it's like what Wynn used to say. You know, if one can do that much damage to that first crew, an army of them, you would never win. You know, they did something. They said something about the blood, though. Something about oxidizing, that it stops being acid after a certain amount of time or something.
Yeah, they made almost so that it wouldn't just eat through everything and stop squirting everywhere the way it does, because it does. You know, in the original, it ate through like four different hulls,
like a bunch of levels of the ship. Yeah.
And they have to make it so that it can just wound people and scar them for life, but not really eat through them, kind of thing. I think the oxygen, the fact that they were terraforming and it was oxygenating the atmosphere, helped with that.
Right. I liked having a little bit of explanation there. Back to scenes. One of the other scenes that really strikes me is after Ripley has rescued Newt. I mean, it's already cool that she's going back, and Bean's like, we're not going anywhere without you. And then she goes and she rescues Newt, and they're running. And I love the way he shot it, because she's running and she stops, and you don't know why she stops. And then they just pull back, and you see that she's in a room just filled with eggs. That is the best moment. And then you've got the queen and her seeing the queen and all of that communication of intelligence with absolutely no dialogue.
Yes.
It's just all done looking around
and the way it looks and moves and everything. Yes.
Right.
16 puppeteers.
Yeah. Including Stan Winston.
Yeah. Genius.
So she knows she's in danger, and she uses the flare gun to barter with the queen. I will torture eggs if you don't tell these guards to back off. And none of this is spoken. It's all just pantomimed. And the queen knows it. So then you go, wait a minute, these things are intelligent.
Or at least communicating somehow with each other.
Right. And then she gets impulsive and just sets them all on fire anyway and pisses her off.
Well, again, and it's another one of those homages, too, because, you know, instead of carrying Jonesy and trying to get to the escape ship during the countdown, she's carrying Newt and trying to get to the spaceship during the countdown.
Oh, my God, David. I thought the same thing. I was like, holy shit, he just took the exact same scene and mm-hmm. inserted it into this film. She's going back for the kid instead of going back for the cat.
Oh, yeah. And you hear the female computer doing the countdown the
right.
whole time.
It's all the same. You
know? Yeah. He's
but
got
it works.
so many elements like that that are homages to the original. You know, Ripley in her underwear. Got to have that. Ripley getting into some strange suit in order to fight the alien one last time. In the original, it was the spacesuit. In this one, it's the big power loader thing. You know?
There's the guy that looks up into the ceiling, and you see the shot of his eyes, just like the shot of her eyes in Alien
mm-hmm.
2.
Yep.
It may be Apone. I can't remember who it is, but it's somebody that climbs up and looks
crawling,
through a ceiling top.
You know, crawling through ducts with only a little flashlight. Mm-hmm. That's very homage to the original. The milk, of course, spewing and everywhere mm-hmm. else, and the whole AI has milk as fluid.
The egg opening. That's egg. Almost virtually the same shot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The whole ending taking place on, you know, the only way to get rid of the alien is with the airlock.
And to jettison
kind of
it. Right.
All of that is all these homages to the original. But he does it in such a way, it's much better than his later movies that to me seem like they're stolen from everything else. Especially like Avatar and Titanic, that seem like I'm just lifting this entire scene from this other movie and I'm going to put it over here. These are much more well thought out, I think. And again, like I said at the beginning, I think it's an extension of the story without retelling the story
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. And I don't think you can have... there was one other scene I was thinking of, and now I've lost it. That I was
going
to
say. Oh, I can probably come up with another. Yeah.
Okay.
Let me just actually click to the next picture. Mostly, they come out at night, mostly.
Yep. Mostly.
No, I'm just kidding. I like the idea of them. Well, it's not really the scene so much as the concept of them trying to barricade themselves, and Vasquez is welding all the doors shut, but it's not going to work.
Makes no difference.
And yeah, no, makes no difference at all. I did have a little bit of trouble with them saying, "Man, they're inside." I'm like, didn't this happen in the first movie? Wouldn't she remember that? Where they're not, you know, level with you, they're above or below. I'm like, why isn't she thinking about that?
Well, again, she thought it was covered because when she asks Hudson, who's freaking out, and she wants to focus him, so she asks him to get the plans, and she says she wants to see everything, sub-basements, levels, everything. Mm-hmm. But nobody thought of, obviously, for some silly reason, nobody thought of above them or even below them, because that's how Hudson gets killed, is somebody pulls him from underneath.
Right.
But again, I think it's a good scene, though. It works for me because they're so terrified, and he's doing the countdown of, you know, 10 meters, 8 meters,
they're inside.
6 meters. And somebody's, and, you know, and Ripley goes, that's impossible. That's inside the room. And then right. Hicks gets up there, and Hicks still lives with 4 aliens chart. No, but anyway, we give it to him. We like
right.
Oh, dear Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening.
Mostly because Paxton has to do the, you want another piece of this? You want some more of this? Come mm-hmm. on, man.
How about you?
Yeah. How about you?
Another scene that does stick out with me is the facehugger scene where Bert traps Ripley and my dog just is now barking.
That's okay.
Traps Newt and Ripley in the lab because he decides that he can perhaps smuggle an alien home if they're impregnated and mm-hmm. asleep. Once they realize what he's up to, she said, they're like, well, how would he get away with this? And she's like, well, he would ambush yours and kill all of you.
Yeah. He would have to see that all the other tubes malfunction, which is
right.
yours. Yeah.
Right. And, but that scene, before we got to the scene where they're onto Burke and his motives. That scene with Newt and her trapped in the room when she's beating on the glass and you hear absolute silence.
Yeah, soundproof.
It's soundproof. They're trapped. There's two of those things in there, and they're very strong. I mean, I was really surprised and a little bit leery of Newt being able to hold the one with the gurney against the wall to keep it from getting at her, because Hudson comes in and has to take over.
Yeah.
And it takes three of them to get it off of Ripley.
Well, because they don't want to rip her head off. Right. Because it's already wrapped around her. I mean,
yeah, because it's like, I want to say it's Hicks and Vasquez and maybe one other that are taking it off her.
Yeah, it's a great scene. And again, homage to the whole lab scene in the original, except that one was done with them slowly, you know, with her and Dallas walking around with those little flashlights, trying to look and see where it was hiding. And it's a kind of a jump scare sort of thing. Whereas this one is just tense the whole time because there's two of them and they're in there.
Yeah, and in the original, it's dead.
But they don't know that.
No.
And we don't know that.
But in this one, you've
audience.
Got two that are crawling around like giant spiders. Man, it's gnarly.
As soon as that one, you know, Newt's in the foreground and that one in the background comes crawling up, I said, oh, I'm sure Tim is having a cow right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. Don't want to be there. No. And then I love how, you know, there's another motif that's it's a little small, but I noticed it. You know, Ripley gets in trouble at the beginning of this movie because she makes decisions, and they're pissed because it's not her money to make these decisions with, as far as destroying that ship because there was an alien on it.
Right.
In this one, she's got friends that are like, oh, yeah, we're going to make the decision. He's dead meat, and they're going to kill Burke. Like, they're all alibis, so if they all come back, they can all just, you know, bond together, and she'll have friends at least.
Definitely.
So, and I had never really picked up on that before. You know, the fact that they were trying to, I don't know what the word is, discredit her for what she did. And you know, because you've seen the movie, what she was going through and why she did it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, any more scenes?
They're all good, basically. I mean, this movie flows really well. It works really well. I definitely, again, emphasize, watch the extended version. I think the pacing works in the extended version for me.
I think it's fine.
I think it works really well. And I would have... maybe it was just window for number of shows at the time that they had to cut it down.
Well, I mean, nowadays is a different audience. I mean, people are sitting 3 hours to watch an Avengers movie. They would sit 2.5 hours to watch this movie.
Yep.
I think it's just a question of the time or the mindset of the time. Another scene, before we move on, I'll go on to awards, but another scene would be when... they think they're safe, and they've landed the ship with Bishop and Ripley and Newt. And, you know, Ripley's congratulating Bishop for not being a bad artificial person. And all of a sudden, something comes through his chest. And you think, holy shit, it's a chest burster. But then you realize, no, it's not. It's the tail of the queen because she is clinging to the outside of the spaceship where she has flown up to the mothership with them. And then you've got the whole, before we get to the bad part, the whole Newt hiding under the floor and the queen picking up the things and trying to get her, and Sigourney has disappeared. She's locked herself away, but then the door opens and she's in the giant exoskeleton thing and says, get away from her, you bitch.
The tagline.
The audience goes nuts every time. It's like one of the classic lines of Hollywood that they always show at Oscars.
Yep. That one, and, you know, I'll be back. And, you know, again, another James Cameron one. There are all those, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I will move on to awards. Sure. This movie won 2 Oscars. It won Best Effects, or Sound Effects, and it won Best Visual Effects. It was nominated for Actress in a Leading Role, Sigourney Weaver, Set Decoration, Sound Editing, and music. And that's something that we did not talk about, but James Horner did the music for this movie. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how much we liked him for The Wrath of Khan and its music.
Mm-hmm.
But this may play into your dislike of James Cameron, because apparently Cameron pushed Horner and did not give him a lot of time. Did you know this?
Hardly any time at all.
Right.
He basically had 6 days to score the movie because it wasn't edited by the time he got to England. He sat around for 3 weeks.
I thought it went from 9 weeks to 6 weeks. You sure it's not 6 weeks?
It might have been 6 weeks. No.
Yeah, I think it was supposed to be 9 weeks, and it went down to a lesser time. I know that.
Correct.
And he, from what he says, he cannibalized a lot of his other films, including Wrath of Khan, for music.
Well, you can tell. I mean, I've got 3 different instances in here where going, okay, this is from Wrath of Khan. As a matter of fact, on the podcast, I will probably play them back to back. So you can
That's hilarious.
But, yeah, it's very Wrath of Khan in its design. The opening is really good, although the opening is very, to me, the key for the opening music is 2001. That theme, that
I love that.
It's very beautiful, but it's very 2001 kind of feel to it. But the rest of the movie is extremely influenced by Wrath of Khan all the way through. He even reused some of Goldstein's music from, or Goldsmith's music from the original in places.
I recognized it. Yeah.
Yep. Because he ran out of time. I don't think it's Horner's best score by any means. I do like a couple of the pieces, but I don't think it's one of his better efforts.
I thought that he won an award, but maybe he didn't. It did not jeopardize his relationship with Cameron, though, because Cameron liked the music for Braveheart so much that he got Horner to do Titanic.
Yeah. Where he did win an Oscar.
Right. That's where I'm thinking that he won an Oscar.
And we haven't talked about it yet. We will, I know. But the effects deserved the Oscar. Mm-hmm. There is no CGI in this movie. It is old school model making. It's puppeteering. It's actual practical effects. And it works. And I so wish Hollywood could go back to that. I really do.
I do. There are a few instances that I don't like, and it has nothing to do with puppetry. It has to do with the visual of one is like when the ship is landing on the planet. It looks like the background does not match to the actual ship. It looks like a film. And the scene where Sigourney is on the platform and everything's blowing up behind her, all that looked fake to me.
Yeah, the three big gaffes, I think, are not as good, but kind of, interesting they tried. But
yeah, they did.
The one you're talking about where they've got obviously a miniature blowing up and it's being rear projected behind her rather than green screen.
Mm-hmm.
The scene where the dropship crashes, because they had already done it and filmed it, so they projected that on a big screen behind them as they go running behind all the rocks.
Right.
In the foreground.
The Star Trek rocks.
Yeah. 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 So both of those
in all honesty, those looked fake to me in 1986. It's not that they look fake now. They looked fake then, too.
Well, and there are times where the puppet doesn't seem to match. I mean, like, especially when right after she says, get away from her, you bitch. No, before that, when she tells Nuke to run and hide, and then she's staring down the queen, and then she takes off running. And the queen runs after her, and it kind of looks like it's floating above the ground. It doesn't match, really.
And another one of those instances with the weird film in the background is after she is pissed off the queen, and the queen is detaching itself from the egg tunnel thing to whatever you want to call it.
Ovipositor.
And there's explosions and shaking, and all of a sudden the queen doesn't look like a puppet anymore. It looks like a film.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Totally
that's
true.
Another one too that I was thinking of. But I mean, those things bothered me a long time ago. They didn't just start bothering me.
But, you know, Stan Winston built that puppet. It's like 16 feet tall.
It's, I mean, it's gigantic. A real,
it's huge.
They had to take off parts of its head to make it fit in the freight elevator because it wouldn't fit in there.
Yeah.
When it follows her up. Yeah.
It's freaking huge. And the the chest buster looks great. The face huggers look great. The ship designs work. I love the gun designs in this movie. Those are
too.
Practical guns.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked really. All of the motion trackers and the technology they used for the motion trackers still work.
Mm-hmm.
I just liked all of the effects in this movie work for me. Even the ones, like you said, that we call out and go, that wasn't the best, but still worked.
No.
You know.
Before we move on, we could also talk more scenes because we're probably going to have to talk the very ending too. But we were in awards, and I mentioned the Oscars. On the other side of the pond, the BAFTAs, it won Best Visual Effects and was nominated for Makeup and Production Design. That's all. So it's kind of the opposite with this film. Usually it's more respected in England, but in this case, it's actually more respected in America.
Well, you know, he's not Ridley.
Well, you know what? That probably has a lot to do with it.
I'm serious. I'm sure it did. The BAFTAs are as political as the Oscars are. I'm sure they had to do with it.
Yeah.
Silly American coming over here trying to make movies
off of our movies. Yes. Our Saturn Awards, the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, it won a lot. It won Best Science Fiction Film, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, Bill Paxton, Best Supporting Actress, Jeanette Goldstein, Best Performance by a Young Actor, Carrie Henn, Best Director, Best Writing, both James Cameron, and Best Special Effects, Stan Winston and his team. All of those were wins with Saturn Awards. That's why I like the Saturn Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Michael Biehn was nominated for actor, did not win. Costumes and makeup did not win at all. And lastly, it is on the 1001 movies you must see before you die, just as its predecessor.
Be. Yep. So, trivia. I've got some trivia about this. It's okay. Kind of cool. It kind of works with everything, but, before, when they were in pre-production, they actually got Sid Mead and Ron Cobb to be designers for the movie. That was brilliant. Sid Mead also did Blade Runner. He also did 2010. He did Tron. Ron Cobb had done Blade Runner. He did Heavy Metal. So they're both brilliant designers, and it really works, I think. And then their actual production coordinator was Peter Lamont, who had come from all the Bond movies. So he was used to big action sequences.
Action sequences, yeah.
And so that helped a lot. You had mentioned Stan Winston. Of course, Stan Winston is great with the makeup on this.
He's attached to most major makeup when you think about him.
Yeah, well, especially all of Cameron. He did Terminator. He did Terminator 2, all of those.
Well, and because of this, he got the Jurassic Park gig.
Yep.
Because Steven Spielberg saw the Alien Queen and said, I need you to build a T-Rex, basically.
Yep. Until they decided to do it with CGI. Mm-hmm. But he still built one practically.
And so he built, like, the that one you always see that's laying down. It's a Triceratops, I think.
Yeah. When this was originally going into production at Pinewood, they called it Superior Firepower. That was its cover name, which I thought was kind of cool for it. I have all these quotes. So talking about Cameron being difficult on set, Stan Winston says, every set with Jim is a little tough. People need to get used to it. Jim insists he gets what he wants, and some people can't handle directors telling them what to do. The special effects guys said, Jim is very demanding and he never takes no for an answer. Working on his set is always tense. He's passionate, hard driving, and frankly, insensitive.
Wow.
I've got Michael Biehn was actually cast on Friday night after 10 p.m. and was on set in England on Monday morning.
Do you know what is ironic about that?
I do not.
John Hurt had the same thing happen to him with the original film.
That's a great key. I did not know that. Really?
Yeah. Yeah, remember he got...
Oh, that's right.
Because he was a last-minute replacement.
He was reading the script on the plane.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. They fired the first DP 2 weeks into production. So kind of interesting. It's kind of like last week when we were talking about Return of the Living Dead, and they fired the makeup guy after a few weeks of production.
But that DP was one of the Brits, from what I understand, that was rebelling against him. And he basically just said, well, fuck it, get out. And I mean, I know he's kind of a tyrant. We know that from the movies we've covered. But I feel for him a little bit on this one because he's kind of a stranger in a strange land.
Right, but he's got a, you know, it's like systemic racism. I mean, you see it throughout all of his movies, you know, when you see an abyss and people don't want to talk with or work with him anymore and stuff like that. So, and I guess one of my latter trivia stories or cool things is Ray Lovejoy was the editor for this. And I think he was nominated for an Oscar. Didn't you say editing?
I did. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was a... Oscar though, it was nominated for editing as an Oscar, but it won editing, I think, for Saturn Award.
Right, but he was nominated, but he was going to be fired, and knew he was going to be fired. He had heard that Galen Hurd and Cameron both wanted to fire him because he was a British editor. They had already had enough trouble with the British crew, and he had most of the movies he had had in the past were not action movies.
This is the one that went on to do Titanic with him, right?
Yes.
Or something. Yeah. There was one that he ended up being friends with, from what I understand.
Well, and here's why. They were going to fire him, and he heard about it. So he stayed up an entire weekend, took all the footage from the finale, from the Queen battle, and edited it all together and showed it to Cameron on Monday morning. Mm-hmm. And Cameron said, all right, you can keep the job. There you go.
I did read that.
I thought that was a really cool story.
Yeah, because they got rid of a lot of that crew that was, I don't know. Anyway, and that was the one guy that they kept and that went on to work with him down the road.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. And I think that's all my little trivia fun stuff, maybe. Audio design for this all the way through is great. I chill up every time. It's just my geek, but... In the beginning, when it's just showing Sigourney asleep in her pod in her shuttle, and you hear the sound effects of the computer coming on, and it's the same as Alien. I love that audio design. I just think it's cool.
I've seen this movie a dozen times, but I had never watched it from this set. It was gorgeous, and that scene, that opening scene, where the the machine thing cuts through the door. I can't think of what it's called.
Yeah. The laser, the whole cutting laser.
Yeah, I mean, all of that is just so crisp and clear. I was just blown away by how beautiful it was. And the blues, all the blues in space.
And that music underneath. The opening sequence is great. It's a great hook. It works so well on so many levels. I did see a trivia thing that said that there were no blueprints of the Sulaco shuttle. So the Sulaco is the shuttle she's in. It came from the Nostromo.
Right.
And that there were no blueprints of it. So they actually had to watch Alien to recreate the interior of that spaceship.
I read that Cameron was such a fanatic for detail that you can see the weapon she used in that shot leaning up, or it's stuck in something.
Well, you can see the helmet, definitely. The helmet's it pans by the helmet as it's going over toward her after the astronauts come.
It's something very trivial where she like lays it down, like maybe she puts the gun down on the counter or something, and in the shot it's still there or something.
Mm.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was exactly, but I thought that was interesting as well, trivia-wise. Yep. Do you want to discuss this sad ending before we do Keys or after?
Yeah, we need to because it sucks. I mean, it...
It could have been fixed so easy.
How would you have done that? Tell me.
I would have had her get out before she... And seal the cabin before she opens the outer door.
Yes. It would have been just as good if she had crawled out and we see the queen trying to climb up and even strong enough to pick up the loader or whatever.
Right.
And
right.
We're afraid that she's going to climb out before Ripley can get the door closed and it would still work.
No. Yeah, but, yeah, exactly. I don't understand it.
Okay. And anybody who, as they used to say, I don't know, dabbles in, I don't know, physics, would know that her entire arm would have been ripped off and she would be out there with the queen had she done that. And you cannot open a vacuum to space and hold on to a ladder with one arm.
Even if it didn't rip it off, it would just yank her out, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Still attached. There's no way she could hold on.
Yeah, no, no. And, I mean, we saw enough in The Martian, you know, a few weeks ago to know how space works. And this is not how space works. No, it does not work. I understand him wanting to keep the airlock as the ultimate way to get rid of the queen. Mm-hmm. Because it also opens it up for a sequel because we don't know if that even kills them or not. We know he killed it in the original because she also blasts it with the engines.
Right.
In the original. But in this one, it leaves the queen floating out there. She could just, you know, attach herself to another wandering ship or whatever. Yeah. But to have Ripley to go through that whole thing and then... Because you still could have had the whole Newt scrambling around the floor or being pulled toward the airlock because the door's not closed at the same time or whatever, maybe. But just, no, it did not work.
Yeah, I don't know. It has something to do with him wanting to amp up the pace and the tension. And I think he could have done it another way that would have been a little more realistic.
Yes.
So that is one part I do have a problem with, more so than even the timeline.
There's another homage right after that, which is near the scene. Even though the scene that you're showing behind you with Bishop, that's a publicity still because he never sits up like that.
It probably is
In the movie. But he does use that same kind of garbled talk when he says, "Good job for a human." Mm-hmm. It sounds like Ash in Alien, you know,
Right.
Kind of the sound. It sounds pretty cool. But yeah, I like the denouement. I like the fact that, you know, it shows her kind of, you know, Ash has his little milk bottle and he's going to sleep and Bishop is going to sleep. And then she and Newt share a mother daughter kind of moment of, can I dream? Yes, of course you can, sort of thing, which makes the beginning of the third movie all
suck.
A worse insult.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's one of the reasons why I don't like it. It's because they kill her and Hicks immediately. And it's like, well, that's the whole plot of the damn second movie, almost.
Yeah. Well, and to Fincher's credit, what he was trying to do was show that in this one, she has no choice. She has to survive herself and for herself. Is the point of it. But
well, and isn't that the one where she lowers herself in the lava at the end, which is just a ripoff of a Cameron Terminator movie?
Well, no, he rips off that later on.
Oh, he does? I thought that was from Terminator 2.
Right, but Terminator
Alien 3
2
came
was...
out after Terminator 2.
Okay, well, then it is a ripoff of that.
Yeah, which is weird. I mean, I'm pretty sure I haven't got IMDb pulled up, but we'll check that later. I'm pretty sure that Alien 3 came out after Terminator 2. Terminator 2 came out in like 1990, 1991.
Yeah, it's probably true.
Yeah.
Probably true.
So that's why I want to watch the work print. I want to see if it's better.
Well, I think Fincher did the best job he could with what he had. I think the original screenplay would have been a lot better. One of the kind of, I watched like a 10-minute little making of thing on 3 before I watched 3.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, it's called Alien 3, which is another problem with it.
Because there was never a 2.
But
yeah.
Yes, but one of the things that they said was...
Aliens.
and this kind of goes along to what we've said in the podcast about a bunch of films, but a singular directorial vision and storytelling sometimes can make something that everybody thinks will not work, work really well. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can have the opposite effect, but the ones that we try to highlight, like, you know, Halloween or Night of the Living Dead, Texas Chainsaw, all of those are auteurs doing their passion projects. Mm-hmm. And they said in this documentary, what made Alien work was Ridley, you know, Ridley storyboarded that entire screenplay before, and they liked it so much, they gave him $10 more million and then trusted him to go make it. Mm-hmm. And said, go make it. We're not messing with you. Go do it.
Yeah.
With this one, it was the same way with Cameron. 20th Century yeah. Fox said, we love this so much. You go make your movie.
Right.
And that's fine. With the third one, Fincher had to stay on, had to do a phone call from England every day for 2 hours, telling him what he had shot, what it looked like, sending them the rushes, and then taking notes from them on what he should change. And it's one of the reasons that he disowned it. One of the reasons that it got so convoluted, you know, originally it was just monks, and that would have played into this whole humanity of Ripley kind of thing. But no, they said prisoners are scarier than monks. That'll be better. So let's make them monastic prisoners. You know. And it just got real convoluted.
I had it mostly backwards. Because I thought they were prisoners that became monks, but I guess I had it the other way around.
No, the original story that came, and I don't remember his name, unfortunately. Sorry. Let me know, guys. But the original story was she crash-landed on a planetoid that was actually, turns out later on to be a spaceship. That was one of the big reveals. That was populated by monks. And that led to the whole story being bought by Fox, and here we go ahead. And then when they fired that writer and brought Fincher on and everything else, then they told him, no, it has to be prisoners now. So you have a woman who crash lands on a planet of prisoners. Yeah.
Didn't yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But it does have some great sequences to it, and I still think Sigourney Weaver and James Dutton both do phenomenal acting jobs in it, given what they have to do.
Right.
But, you know, it got terrible reviews. It didn't work well. It had some issues, but...
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we talked about... first of all, this is a great film. We talked about it could have had a slightly better ending.
Yes.
Let's move on to Keys, because I think we're running a little long here.
A little.
A little.
Yeah.
Do you want to go
first? I only have a few because I've mentioned a bunch already.
I mentioned the one about John Hurt, which I found coincidental, too.
I mentioned the one that the whole opening is very inspired by the first... space section of 2001, the second section.
Okay.
With that, I've got the whole going to red for the suspense, like they cut the power. Mm-hmm. Right when they're getting ready to kill Burke, he goes, no, yeah, we'll throw him out an airlock, no offense. The power that cuts, and they... And Ripley goes, they cut the power. And Hicks goes, how can they, man? They're aliens.
No, it's Hudson, you know. But yeah.
Hudson, yeah. How can they, man? They're animals. but everything suddenly goes to backup power, which is red.
Right.
And that's then been used in every submarine movie since then. Every time they go to backup power, it's red.
Right.
Which was good and suspenseful. It worked.
Yeah.
That was a key I had.
One of the things that it reminded me of is Starship Troopers, because of all the military aspects.
Oh, yeah. Well, not only that, it reminds me both of the book and the film of mm-hmm. Starship Troopers. The whole hyper-macho dialogue is very Starship Troopers the movie,
yeah.
But the whole dropship, colonial marines, da-da-da-da, all of that is very...
And yeah. Hudson says they're going on a bug hunt.
A bug hunt, yep. Yeah. I've got that one in there, too.
So that was one that I picked up on. I have a few that I lifted from IMDb as well that I did not know. I found a little fascinating. Did you know that Vasquez apparently inspired the character of Tasha Yar on Next Generation?
No, but that makes perfect sense. Okay. That's good. A big military officer. That works.
Apparently, this is even further. Goldstein was initially considered for the part.
Mm.
And she went on later to do an appearance in the movie Generations. But she didn't obviously get the part. That went to Denise Crosby.
Okay.
So I thought that was
interesting. That's interesting. I have Asimov's Laws of Robotics from iRobot.
Right.
Bishop actually says he cannot harm or through omission allow a human to come to harm, which is the laws of robotics.
Mm-hmm. I had that one as well.
The second and third law. Yep.
I've not read that book, but I knew that they had lifted it for a way of making Bishop more benevolent than malevolent, mm-hmm. like Ash. Yep. I have another one that you'll love if you don't know, is that Bill Paxton's character Hudson was inspired by Guy Fligman. He went on to inspire of Guy Fligman from Galaxy Quest, which we yep. did last season.
Yep.
And also starred yep. Sigourney Weaver. That's crazy.
Perfect. Perfect.
So, and who is that guy? Sam Rockwell played him?
Sam Rockwell.
Yeah. So
he played Guy.
And there are moments in Galaxy name. Quest that he reminds me of Hudson a little bit. Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
haven't
definitely.
You seen
that's
the film?
And that's why the other character looks at him and goes, "Have you ever thought that you might be the plucky comic relief?"
Exactly. You know?
I've got Assholes and Elbows. You already mentioned it, but mm-hmm. it actually is used a couple of times, in Full Metal Jacket. And they were filming Full Metal Jacket at the same time as this movie. It was being filmed on the other side, in the other side of London.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
I don't even need to go into this probably. The reason I know the phrase assholes and elbows is because that's what David Farmer's sister Teresa said was what chicken nuggets were made up out of. Because, it's all those weird little bits of chicken. You don't know what they yep. are. She used to say they're assholes and elbows. And I was like, ugh.
Perfect. That's great.
Line that actually was lifted when Hudson says, "Stop your grinning and drop your linen." That's from mm-hmm. the AC/DC song, Shake a Leg.
Excellent. That's
so
a good
that
one.
Came from Australia, because that's an Australian band.
I've got when, again, in the same scene with Bishop, he mentions the Hyperdyne system, which is a variation of Cyberdyne, which is Terminator.
Right. Didn't he try to connect these movies? I think he did. Like in
well,
the
they
same
easily
world.
Could have been in a similar world. Mm-hmm. Not so much Blade Runner, but definitely Terminator could
right.
be in the same world.
Right. The last one I have, I actually lifted from IMDb because I did not know it, but I found it fascinating. And it was what you were talking about with when Hudson says, "Hey, Vasquez, have you ever been mistaken for a man?" And she looks at him and says, "No, have you?"
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah. And that's actually a borrowed line from Hollywood legend Tallulah Bankhead when a columnist, Earl Wilson, asked her if she had ever been mistaken for a man. And she said, "No, darling, have you?" So that's like old Hollywood, key, for lack of better words, where I don't know if that, if anyone had heard that story, but it's kind of coincidental if they hadn't.
Yep. I've got a few semi-hidden ones. So one, people being cocooned, that's actually from the cut scenes of the original script of Alien.
Right.
They never are cocooned in Alien, but in Aliens they are. He continues the mythos.
There's some scenes shot from Alien that didn't make the cut.
Yes,
there's
with
one
Dallas.
Of Tom Skerritt, I believe, in one.
Yeah, with Dallas. Mm-hmm. There's one with Dallas, because Ripley finds him and has to kill him.
Right.
Kind of like what they do in this scene, mm-hmm. which is kind of so it's lifted kind of from that. Another one I've got is the whole scene, like you mentioned it when she, but this is before she finds Newt, when she is looking for Newt. She's done the whole, "I'm getting equipped in the elevator," and now I'm going to go look for Newt. And there's all kinds of gases spurting because the whole terraforming thing is about to explode. But it's very Terminator, with her walking on all the wired and going up and down the stairs, right, and all. It reminds me of that scene in Terminator, or especially in Terminator 2 when they're in the foundry. So it's kind of like a key forward and a key backward,
right,
to me.
Right. Well, I mean, you could basically key it to any Alien movie or any Cameron movie almost, because you could key it to Avatar with Sigourney Weaver. But, I mean, obviously there's not that much connection to Avatar.
Right, but showing the female heroine with her gun and all this atmospheric stuff and she's going on the hunt, that was very,
very
Terminator-y to me. Trivia. I've got a few more trivia. So the alien scream is a baboon scream.
I read that. That's interesting.
I saw that, and I thought that was interesting. You do not see any reference to an alien for an hour of this movie.
Wow.
You know, you see Sigourney's stomach, but that's an effect, and it doesn't
really
work.
Yeah, and it's a dream sequence. I loved, I don't get bored, though, because I think it's, I love the story of her, and then I especially love getting introduced to all the Marines.
Yeah, I think he needed it, and I think it works, because once you do see them, it, you know, it's one of those where, okay, we've opened the worms, now here they go.
Right.
You know, kind of thing. And just a little bit of trivia thing that people don't realize, and I thought was a cool story that was in two different little documentary things I watched, but they hired the Skotak. They're two brothers, Robert and Dennis Skotak, and they were huge in the miniature world. They built miniatures, really detailed miniatures, and did a lot of great work in England. They were hired to do a lot of the miniature effects. So they like built the little radio, like the APC that you see, the vehicle they're in. There was a full scale one that they did, but it basically, it was a modified sled that pulled huge aircraft carriers. I'm not aircraft carriers, but bombers.
Mm-hmm.
So it moved very, very slowly. It can never move fast. So anytime you're seeing that move fast, it's a little like 18-inch remote control vehicle in miniature sets. So all that is miniature sets. The colony, when you see the colony and see the sign of the bar and all the stuff, all of those are miniatures.
Wow.
That's not real sets. And the one that got me and it left for a cool story was when they do that scene we like, when they first transition into the alien hive and you see the organic ceiling and everything else.
That's miniature.
That's a miniature. That's a forced perspective miniature. And they, when Cameron showed it to Fox, or Gail and Hurd actually showed it to Fox, they said, hey, where's all of our money going? Where are the special effects? And she goes, you just saw them because that's a miniature. And they were going, what?
Right.
And fooled all
the executives. Well, and they thought that he was blowing money on set building.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I read that too. Yeah. That's interesting. I
thought that was a cool story.
I think so too. I read something that I don't know if you read. It's not in the extended version, but there's a scene shot that was cut, just like the Dallas scene, with Hudson. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, when she goes to rescue Newt, I guess as they're leaving, they see Hudson cocoon. Oh. And he has already been impregnated. And he's like, you got to kill me or whatever. And she gives him an explosive. Yeah. And they get on, like, the elevator, and, like, there's a scene in the elevator where there's, like, an explosion, and it tilts, and you see them move. That was supposedly Bill Paxton, blowing himself up.
Oh, cool.
And I never really knew that, and I was like, I wonder why they cut it. I guess because they put all that other stuff back in. Why did they put that back
in? Yeah, they even put the hamsters in the damn extended. That's the scene they should have cut and put that in instead.
So, but that's interesting. Like Dallas in the first film, that one stayed on the floor. It never got in the movie.
I did not know that. That's a good one.
Yeah.
I had one other one that was really cool, and now I can't find it in my notes because I've gone away.
Oh, I need to cut my last picture.
I might have to... I've got those are damn big ducks. So that's very Star Trek to me, because they're literally crawling through these.
Except for the one that Bishop has to get in. It's damn small.
Yeah, that one's cool, though, and claustrophobic. So that one works for me.
I may be an android, but I'm not stupid.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it? Oh, the scene where Ripley, the scene, the extended version where Ripley's looking at her daughter, that's Sigourney Weaver's mother.
Oh,
the
that's
picture
cool.
is her real mother.
The one where she's like sitting in front of a holodeck, that was kind of weird.
Yeah, they did that, but that's okay. I think they might have those, at least walls like that. We almost have them now.
I thought it was cool, actually. Kind of that's what made me realize I've never seen this before. Because as soon as I saw it, I went, what is that?
Yeah, and I've never seen that before.
No.
Where did that come from? Uh-huh. Yeah. But yeah, that's Sigourney's real mother in the shot, and I thought that was a really cool thing for Cameron to do and for them to do together for that.
And you're speaking, that's all. For those of you out there, he's speaking of Ripley's 67-year-old dead daughter. Yeah, I think she was 60-something.
Yeah, because she said she would be back for her 10th birthday.
Right.
And she never made it back. Yeah.
And it had been 57 years.
And it gives Ripley so much more character development just in those like four lines of dialogue and the way they do that scene. And again, it's one of those where I would recommend you watch the extended version before you watch the original.
Yeah, there's a lot about this movie that I love, including catchphrases, other than mostly. There's a lot of stuff that I remembered and said as she was saying it. Like, did IQs just rapidly drop in this room? You know, when she's trying to say, are you not listening to me? This thing is not safe or whatever, you know. There's there's lots of good lines besides Hudson in this movie.
Yeah, there are. She has a lot. She and Newt have some great dialogue with each other. I mean, this is, I'm glad you picked this for our 100th, because it's a very enigmatic movie that I think influenced a lot of filmmaking and influenced a lot of people's views of, I don't have to just retell the story again. I can tell it in a different way. I wish more people still took that to heart, but they don't as much.
When you mentioned sequels, I would have put Road Warrior in there too, because I thought that was a brilliant sequel to Mad Max.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Every Road Warrior sequel has continued the line, even down to Fury Road.
Right.
Have been the best examples of sequels.
Yeah. But I chose this because it's both horror and sci-fi, and I thought it just would be appropriate for a 100th episode. So.
Yep. It merges our genres and it works. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't talk about the jump scare of the vagina facehugger kind of jumping out at Burke.
Right. Kind of thing, with the little thing that comes out.
Which is a great scare. I mean, it's just so, whoa, where'd that come from? Dude, you know, it's great.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, we would like to thank everybody for joining us for our 100th episode. Maybe we'll see you on number 200. Who knows?
Who knows?
We definitely have, 36 more movies to go this season.
This season, yes.
I think, or 34. I can't remember what episode. This is our fourth.
There's a bunch.
Yeah. It'd be 36, so. If you are not watching us on YouTube, you can, and I do keep pictures and stuff up from the movie behind me to try to keep people in on remembering if they haven't seen it in a while. And if you are watching us on YouTube, please like and subscribe and ring the bell. We are doing a show called X-Files Declassified over on Patreon. That is a subscription-based show, but it also is on the same tier as another show we do called The Dilithium Chamber, which is on Star Trek, the first original series season. But we also do a lot of free things over there on Patreon, too, so check us out. Anything else you got going, David, that we should
We'll see you next week when we do whatever we do next week.
Oh, next week we're in horror world, and you're in for a doozy, trust me.
Okay. All righty then. We'll be doozying next week with the doozies.
Okay.
Jim, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, and we'll see you later.
See you later.
Bye.